Welcome to Warriors for Peace. This weekly broadcast honors the men and women from different countries and cultures who have served and fought in various ways for the peace and rights that freedom brings. There are those also who serve daily to help preserve peace and the rights that come with freedom. I call these individuals Warriors for Peace. This is Donna Sebo, and I will be your host for the next hour. My guest today is Steve Snyder. He is the author of an extremely powerful book, Shot Down. This is the true story of a pilot, Howard Snyder, his dad, and the crew of the B-17, Susan Ruth. Steve, I want to welcome you to Warriors for Peace.
Well, thank you very much, Donna. I'm delighted to be here.
I mentioned to you before we went on air how in reading the book, Shot Down, it was tremendously emotional for me. And it's emotional because it is a historical documentation, not just about your dad, but also about the men and the women whose lives were so powerfully affected by the horrific attitudes and determinations of destruction by one human being that spread like a virus, a hideous virus, touching everything and creating such hideous, hideous distortion. Steve, you have done such research on this. Give us a little background on yourself, and how long did it take you to compile all of this information, this documentation about the Second World War?
Okay. Well, I was born in Pasadena, California, but moved to a nearby neighborhood, San Marino, when I was about two. San Marino was the home of the famous World War II general, George Patton. His dad was the first mayor of San Marino, actually. And after graduating from high school there, I went to UCLA, where I got my degree. Went into the National Guard for 6 years, and then had a 40-year career in sales and sales management, working for a company based in Sacramento, California, called Vision Service Plan. I live in Seal Beach, California, with my wife, Glenda, where we raised three sons. And I, growing up, I knew the basic history of my dad's war experiences. I knew he was a B-17 pilot. He was stationed with the 306 Bomb Group in England. His plane was named the Susan Ruth after my oldest sister, who was 1 year old at the time that my father went overseas. He flew combat missions over Europe. He was shot down over Belgium. He was missing in action for 7 months, but he evaded capture and eventually ended up joining the French resistance group, the Maquis, and started sabotaging convoys before finally being liberated by the U.S. Army. But it wasn't until I retired in 2009 that I really had the time to delve into my dad's war experiences in further detail, trying to learn more. And probably the most significant document that I looked at, and my parents' keepsakes, were all the letters that my father had written to my mother while he was stationed in England. And they were absolutely fascinating, and I became fascinated with the story of my father and his crew, and it really became my passion. But it was never my intention to write a book, actually. I just wanted to delve into it more. And I started reading book after book about the air war in Europe. Went on the internet and spent countless hours doing research, downloading declassified military information and documents. I joined numerous World War II organizations and started going to reunions and listened to veterans tell their story. And it wasn't until 2012 that I actually decided to write a book. I came to the conclusion that the story of my dad and his crew was so unique and so compelling that it needed to be told and people needed to read about it. So from the time I started my research, from the time the book was published, was 4.5 years.
Wow. It's incredible. The detail, the documentation you have here of this segment of history is just phenomenal. And you have written about so many of the different individuals whose paths crossed with your dad. Now, let's talk a little bit about pilot training. I think there's a lot of young men and women that when they think of going into the military, the idea of becoming a pilot is really very special. But when you step back into World War II, you had a whole different level of experience. And to complete a pilot course, and this was in the 40s, was exceptionally difficult. And you state in your book almost 40% of those that entered failed to complete the primary, basic, or advanced stage of pilot instructions. This was really, really a challenge. To be a good pilot, you had to not only be mentally super sharp, but you had to physically really be strong. Tell us about that.
Yes, well, initially, the men had to go through pre-flight training before they were even accepted in pilot school. And they had to pass a number of tests, mathematics and a lot of different disciplines. They had to go through what was kind of equivalent to basic training with, physical training. And if they showed the mental aptitude and physical aptitude, they were then accepted into the Army Air Corps. And they started with primary training, which my dad took in Santa Maria, California. And there they flew an old twin-wing biplane. And if they could graduate through primary training, then they went on to basic training, where they went from a bi-wing plane to a single-wing plane. And then from there, they went on to advanced training if they could graduate from basic. And actually, after basic, they split the pilots into two different groups. One group went into single-engine planes or fighters, and the other group went into multi-engine planes or bombers. Typically, the shorter pilots went into fighter planes because of the cramped conditions of the cockpit. Mm-hmm. My dad was almost 6'3", so they put him into multi-engine planes, but also was based on personality. Typically, the fighter pilots tended to be more individualistic, have pretty big egos, be cocky, risk-takers, whereas the bomber pilots tended to be more level-headed and team players. So it was very arduous training that they had to go through and pass.
Now, the U.S. was late in going into the war, and your dad was a pilot of the B-17. And maybe many of our listeners would recognize the Memphis Belle. That was a plane that has a movie was made about it, I believe, and there was just a lot of history with Memphis Belle. But the B-17 was a plane that the Germans had a great deal of respect for. Why?
Well, B-17 was nicknamed a Flying Fortress, and that was because of the armament that it carried on the plane. It had 12 to 13 50 caliber machine guns, and it could put out a tremendous amount of firepower. The B-17 was actually one of two bombers that were flown over Europe during the war. The other was a B-24 Liberator. But my dad's group, the 306 bomb group, and he flew the B-17. And they were also able to take a tremendous amount of battle damage and keep flying. It's incredible to look at some of the pictures of the damage that those planes took during bombing missions, and they still made it back to England. And on the bombing missions, the 8th Air Force, which was called the Mighty 8 because of the number of bombers they could put up on missions, these B-17s with all that firepower, would fly in tight formations of hundreds of planes, so it was very ominous for those German fighter pilots to see those bombers coming over.
Mm-hmm. It was. But there was also a challenge because were there not three levels of bombers? I was astonished to find out that there were like layers of planes. And when you think of the technology we have today, and every once in a while we hear of a crash that two planes have, you know, run into each other. And in that time, when you were flying those planes, whoever was flying those planes, they would encounter horrific weather. They didn't have the sophisticated equipment like we've got today to detect people. They didn't even have that sophisticated a communication system between the pilots of these planes. And there were some pretty devastating accidents, weren't there?
There sure were. There were 40 different bomb groups, of which the 306 was one, stationed in England, American bomb groups. And on a mission, they had hundreds of bombers taking off from all these bases at the same time, and there was no air traffic control back then, no radar. It was all based on visual sight, and as you mentioned, the weather was usually bad in England, overcast and cloudy, and typically they couldn't see anything until they got above the cloud layer. So mid-air collisions were not uncommon, and then they had to form up. Individual planes formed up into three plane elements into squadrons into groups into combat wings into divisions, and that took an hour to 2 hours before they could even head across the English Channel on their bombing run.
Incredible. You talk about the devastating loss rates in the first part of the war that we were engaged in. And that was because these massive flying fortresses, huge numbers of them up in the air, they were literally sitting ducks for the Germans, and they put so much flak in the air that these planes were horrifically damaged. When was it that they finally got a fighter plane in there, the Mustang, to be able to escort the B-17s? The losses were just tremendous.
Yes, during the early years of the air campaign in 1942 and 1943, the 8th Air Force took devastating losses. It was 8th Bomber Command belief at the time that all these heavily fortified bombers flying in a tight formation of hundreds of planes could defend themselves from the German Air Force, the Luftwaffe. But sadly, that was not the case at all. In the early part of the war, they just didn't have the fighter escort that could protect the bombers. When the 8th Bomber Command finally realized that they did need fighter support, the problem was that the two fighters at the time, the P-47 Thunderbolt and the P-38, my mind's escaping me here. I'll think of it in a minute. Anyway, the P-38 Lightning is what it was called. They didn't have the fuel capacity to escort the bombers all the way to the target. They could just get a little ways into mainland Europe, and they had to turn around and head back to England because they were running low on fuel. Well, the German fighters, they just hovered in the sky until they saw the American fighters going back to England, and then they swooped down to attack the bombers. It wasn't until the beginning of 1944 when the P-47 had auxiliary fuel tanks attached to the wings, and with the introduction of the P-51 Mustang, that the planes had adequate escort support that could be with the bombers all the way to the target and back.
Now, there were 10 men on the crew of the B-17. Naturally, the pilot, you had a co-pilot, you had a navigator, and you had a flight engineer. And this intrigued me because I don't know if anybody's ever, who's listening to the show, has ever stood inside of a B-17. They're massive. They are absolutely massive. The size of the plane is just something that when you think of it, even being able to get up off the ground, you look at it and say, how does it do it? It's just huge. But a flight engineer, he had to know everything about that plane. And he also had to man guns. And the responsibilities of each of the men, the radio operator, the ball turret gunner, and the tail gunner, all of these people that had to be on there, and so many of them were so vulnerable. Some of them in these positions, they could not even have a parachute on. If they needed to jump out of the plane, they couldn't even wear it because they were in such cramped spaces. Tell us a little bit about these men.
Yes, as you mentioned, B-17 had a 10-man crew, 4 officers, and 6 enlisted men or non-commissioned officers who were mainly gunners. The 4 officers were the bombardier, the navigator, the first pilot, which my dad was, and a co-pilot. And as you mentioned, it was pretty cramped inside those planes, even though they looked pretty big from the outside. And as such, they didn't wear their parachutes. They had a parachute harness that they wore. And if they needed to bail out, they had to have the wits about them and the wherewithal to grab their parachute. And then it had clips that they hook on to the harness, and then they were able to bail out of the plane.
Now, there is a comment that you make in here about the combat wing of a 108 B-17G aircraft. They carried about 5,000 rounds of ammunition, and in combat could bring the equivalent of over 1,000 machine guns firing 14 rounds a second with an effective range of 600 yards. That's very interesting. But I thought what was even more fascinating is that 37% to 50% of the planes had mechanical problems. They had to be worked on all the time, and the ground crews. These men were amazing what they were able to put together, do with these planes that were damaged. I listened to stories of people whose dads were in those mechanical crews, and they had to be really ingenious in some of their solutions for the damages that occurred.
Oh, they sure did, Donna. The combat crews who flew the planes, they got all the glory and the honors, but really they couldn't have done their job if it wasn't for the ground crews. When those planes came back from a mission, those ground crews worked all night doing maintenance on the planes, repairing battle damage, refueling the planes, rearming the planes. So really they were the unsung heroes of the 8th Air Force. They really worked hard, and they really considered those planes to be their planes because they became so close with them. They kind of thought of the bomber crews just renting them or borrowing the planes for their bombing missions.
Oh, yes. I have found that those that are really mechanically skilled, that the planes are like living entities to them. They will talk to their machines, and this may sound a little wacky, but I know it for a fact. Those planes are like living entities. And when they'd have come back and they were wounded, they would just get so agitated. It was really a very powerful combination of people that made those planes available to go up and do the jobs that they need to do. Now, something that I had no knowledge about was contrails. And you have some fabulous photographs in this publication, Shot Down. And the contrails that the B-17s left in the air actually made them vulnerable to attack.
Yes, you mentioned the pictures. There's over 200 time period photographs in the book, which helps people, readers, kind of visualize and see the people and the places that are talked about in the book. But the contrails were formed from the exhaust of the planes hitting the cold air at the altitude that the planes were flying. They typically flew between 20 and 30,000 feet. And it's 40 to 60 degrees below zero at that elevation. So these contrails would form, and really they caused two problems. One, because there were so many planes in the sky, And these contrails would form that it'd almost be like fog or overcast. So it made the visibility very low and poor for these bombers. But also the Germans could see these contrails in the sky, and it all would mark where the bombers were. So they were easily seen from the ground.
The photos that you have of planes that landed, by all rights, they shouldn't have even have been able to stay in the air, are incredible. And then you also bring out the fact that when these planes were damaged, many times they would fall apart in air, and those materials from the plane would land in the country, and this was in England. So there was always a danger. And you tell, you know, of the people on the ground, farmers, people that were just maybe out cutting hay, that they could be injured by this. And you tell stories of pilots who made sure to the best of their capacity, and it was really hard to do if their plane was seriously damaged, trying to land in an area where civilians would not be killed or be injured or their properties destroyed. These are very profound stories. You don't hear about this.
No, you don't. But as you mentioned, it was dangerous from the time these crews took off to the time they came back. And they could crash either on takeoff or on landing. And as you mentioned, people would be in their houses or out and working their farm, and you know, parts of the plane or planes could come crashing down, explode. Ammunition could be firing off. Sometimes they still carried bombs, and bombs would be exploding. So it was pretty horrific at times for the locals, too. And unlike in the United States, where bases were spread out in faraway places, really out-of-the-way places, in England, they were right amongst all the villages and all the people that lived in an area called East Anglia.
There was a particular period that you talk about, and it was Black Week. I'd never heard of it. Black Week. This was engagement in air battle that was just a slaughter. What was Black Week, and where did it happen?
Well, it was in the fall, or October, actually, of 1943, where during a week, the 8th Air Force went on four bombing missions, or four raids, and during that time, they lost 150 planes, which amounts to 1,500 men. Culminating with Black Thursday, which was the second Schweinfurt raid. At Schweinfurt, Germany, it was the hub of Germany's ball-bearing industry. And everything that is made during back then in the war took ball bearings, whether it's trucks, airplanes, what have you. So it was critically important to the German war machine. The Schweinfurt factory had been bombed in the previous August, where they also took very heavy losses. But at the second Schweinfurt raid on October 14th, they lost 60 bombers, 600 men on that one raid. And that was just devastating. The 8th Air Force stood down for several days after that to try to recoup. My dad and his crew were actually replacements to that second Schweinfurt raid. They came over on October 21st. So it was in the bomber command, or actually President Roosevelt, thought about possibly scrapping the whole air campaign because they just couldn't sustain those losses. Mm-hmm. And again, it was fortunate that the P-51 Mustang came along right after that, beginning of the following year, that they had those escorts that could protect them from the German fighters, as well as the anti-aircraft cannons or flak.
You interviewed a German pilot, and he made statements because he was the bad guy, and we were fighting against Hitler. He was a pilot, loved flying, And he survived in the Second World War. And I remember the comment, and I don't know if it was Hans Berger, I believe it was, but he made the comment of it all seemed like such a waste when he reflected on the massive amounts of loss of life that occurred all across the board. And that he knew as a pilot that he had caused some of that. And it was interesting, the commentary that he gave you.
Very much so. When I was doing my research, my wife suggested, why don't I try to find the pilot that shot down my dad's plane, which I thought was kind of a crazy idea. There's no way I'm ever going to be able to do that. But being a good husband, I said I'd try, and lo and behold, I found Hans Berger. He was one of two German fighter pilots that attacked my dad's plane and shot it down. The other pilot, Siegfried Merrick, his plane crashed, and he died in the plane. And Hans Berger, who was shot down by my dad's gunners on his plane, he was able to bail out of the plane, and he made it through the war. And fortunately for me, he became a translator after the war, so he speaks perfect English, and we communicated via email and over the telephone, and he did give me some wonderful insight about what it was like to go up against the 8th Air Force. In Germany, they didn't have any limits on the number of missions you could go on. Either did the 8th Air Force, actually, at the beginning of the war. That's what caused really bad morale as well. But then they finally realized that they had to put a mission limit, which originally was 25, so these U.S. pilots had some hope that they would make it through the war. But the German pilots had no mission limit. They flew until they were killed or so badly wounded they couldn't fly anymore. Mm-hmm. And Hans Berger lost almost all his friends during the war. And he realized what a tragedy it was. He was not a Nazi. He was really just like the American airman, a young 19, 20-year-old young man, trying to do a job and trying to stay alive. Mm-hmm. And he commented that it was a good thing that the Americans won the war, because what Hitler was up to was not good.
Yes, and we'll cover some of that. Now, your dad and his crew, they were really quite a team. And I think those groups that flew together, it was an extended family. You had to depend on each other. It's very, very much what most young men and women will say today. Even retired military personnel will say about the teams that they work with, that sometimes those teams, depending on what combat that they have been involved with, become even closer to them than members of their own family, because you share experiences, you live them together, and you survive together, if that is, you might say, and the possibility arena. Now let's talk about Belgium, because the information that you have in your book about the planes, the various things that people went through, the Caterpillar Club, which is associated with parachutes, and that's because they were made of silk, and that parachute could save your life, and that's how the club was formed. When we get to your dad's flight, where he was shot down, and he landed in a tree, it's like something out of a Hollywood movie. He lands in a tree and is hanging there with his parachute.
Right.
What happened to the plane and the crew?
Okay. Well, it was on February 8th, which is coming up pretty soon, in 1944. On a mission to Frankfurt, Germany, or my dad's plane, they released their bomb successfully, but their bomb bay doors got hit by flak or anti-aircraft fire, and they couldn't raise the bomb bay doors back up. And as a result, that caused a drag on the plane, and they lost airspeed. They were unable to keep up with the formation of bombers heading back to England after the bomb run. And they were singled out by two German Focke-Wulf 190 fighters. And in the ensuing air battle, Susan Ruth was shot down. two crew members died in the plane, the radio operator and the ball turret gunner. And the other eight airmen or members of the crew were able to bail out successfully. My dad, being the commander of the crew, was the first pilot, was the last crewman to bail out. And as you mentioned, he came down right at the French-Belgian border, and his parachute got hung up into some trees, and he was dangling 20 feet off the ground. It was wintertime, so there was snow on the ground and not many leaves on the tree. It was around noon time. And luckily for him, a couple of young Belgian farmers saw him come down and came over to where he landed and saw his plight, went back to the farmhouse, brought a ladder to help him get down, and then told him to stay put because there were German patrols all around the area looking for these airmen that had bailed out. They said they'd come back that night and get him, which they did.
Now, there are some details that just, they don't surprise me, and it's about Hitler. But I did not know about Nacht und Nebel, which is night and fog decree that was put out. And the order was by the Nazis that those that they perceived as their enemies would not be put to death, but put to an endless night of silence to make them vanish, never to be seen again. The secret police, the various groups, created terror, you said, throughout Europe because of this one edict.
Yes, it was amazingly hard and terror-filled for the local citizens, whether it's in any of the occupied countries, whether it's France or Belgium or the Netherlands. They ruled with an iron fist, and anyone caught protesting or doing anything to hinder the Nazi cause were severely punished. Either they could be executed or sent to concentration camps. And the people that aided the downed airmen were unbelievably brave. As I mentioned earlier, my father was missing in action for 7 months. And he was hidden by various Belgian people during that period of time. How long he stayed at any place depended on how brave the people were who lived there and how dangerous the underground thought it was for him to stay there. And he was moved from place to place to place. He might spend one night at one location or up to 6 weeks at another location. But they risked their lives and those of their families by aiding these downed airmen. And a number of the people that helped my dad and other members of the crew either were executed or sent to prison camps and tortured.
Belgium was a neutral country, and its dilemma was that the Germans used it as a pathway. It was a very strategic piece of country to utilize to get through to France, and they were ruthless, absolutely ruthless. Now, then the underground developed, and it was the secret army, you said, in the north, and the White Brigade in the south. This was a very small group of people, but the other information that you give is that yes, the genocide committed by the Nazis of 6 million Jews is very real. However, very rarely is it mentioned. Romanians, Soviet Union prisoners of war, Polish and Soviet citizens, the handicapped, homosexuals, and other undesirables were put to death, and the tally is more over 20 million people that were murdered.
Yes, the killing that the Nazis did was just unfathomable. It boggles the mind.
Yes,
on the people that suffered, and when you consider, you know, all the people that were left homeless, and it's amazing.
Now, your dad became a part of the Maquis, and I may be mispronouncing it, M-A-Q-U-I-S?
Yeah, Maquis.
Maquis. Who were these people? And I was just amazed to find that one of the leaders that had been so incredibly successful was a woman.
Yes. Well, you really had the underground, and then the resistance was kind of a separate group of people. The underground helped and aided airmen. They hindered the Germans, but they didn't get involved directly in fighting against the Germans.
Mm-hmm.
The resistance was more combative, and they were armed, and they attacked Germans in convoys and the such. When my dad first came down, he was hidden by the underground. And typically, when the underground aided downed airmen who was able to evade capture, they tried to get them back to England through France, across the Pyrenees into Spain, and then out through British-controlled Gibraltar, then back to England. But something always went wrong trying to get my dad out. Some of these escape routes were compromised.
Mm-hmm.
And it became too dangerous. And finally, my father got tired of hiding, and he decided to join the French resistance, the Maquis group. Again, he was right at the Belgium-French border, so he was hiding and being hidden in Belgium. And when he joined the French resistance group, the Maquis, he went right across the border where they stayed in a farmhouse. And then he began sabotaging German convoys. He thought rather than just hide, he might as well get back into the fighting, and rather being the hunted, it'd be better to be the hunter.
Mm-hmm. Andrée was the woman. She was 26 years old. Eventually, she was caught by the Germans, and she was tortured. Her story is quite amazing because the Pyrenees were the mountains that this Comet Line, I believe that's what it was called.
Yes.
And her nickname was Didi, but it stretched for 1,200 miles. To even imagine going 1,200 miles through those mountains in winter, and it was a bitterly cold winter. That's incredible.
Yeah, there were various escape routes through France and into Spain, but the Comet Line was the most famous and probably the largest of the lines. And these men, you know, they were downed airmen. They're going over these mountains, and all they had was just either probably some civilian clothes that the underground had given to. You know, they didn't have any hiking boots or hiking gear or cold weather gear. So it was very treacherous, dangerous, both just physically demanding. Plus you had, you know, Germans looking for them. You had infiltrators. So it was very dangerous for those men who came over the Pyrenees and then tried to escape.
Yes, it was. I was not only amazed at the photography. My question many times when I looked at these different photographs is, who had the camera? Because these were people, many of them are not even alive today, and yet there were photos of the airmen with some of the people that saved their lives. And you bring out a point about the airmen that once they landed after they had come out of their broken up planes, they were very quickly and easily captured. But there were parts of the story that I didn't know about. I didn't know that they had just executed a lot of the airmen, just lined them up and shot them, because that's what they were told to do, just kill people.
Yes, typically when guys bailed out of the planes, the Germans were on them pretty quick and captured them, and they became prisoners of war. In fact, three of my dad's crew were captured immediately. The flight engineer, top turret gunner that you mentioned earlier, Roy Hulbert, he spent the entire war in a prison camp, and he had some harrowing experiences himself. And two of the other crew members, a waist gunner and the bombardier, they were severely injured. The waist gunner had his foot blown off, and the bombardier almost lost his arm. It was so badly damaged, and they were eventually repatriated back to the United States before the war ended. And then if you could kind of get away initially and evade capture, at least temporarily, then you could try to hook up some of the members of the underground and be helped. There was one other member of my dad's crew, the tail gunner, William Bill Schlenker, that he actually evaded capture the whole time, too. My dad was not with him. And as opposed to my dad, who was moved from house to house all around, Bill Schlenker, he stayed with one woman and her two daughters the entire 7 months.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then the three other members of my dad's crew, they evaded capture for a while, hooked up with five other downed U.S. airmen from three other planes, and were aided by the underground and the resistance for a while, but they eventually were captured.
I was really quite surprised to find that through the Red Cross, supplies could be sent to POW camps. And when I read that, I went, that is amazing, because there was a Stalag, a concentration camp, one of them, where the men were actually able to have something to eat because of these Red Cross parcels. How was that possible?
Well, they did a wonderful job, the Red Cross, during the war. And these prisoner of war camps, the men were fed very little. But Switzerland at the time, being a neutral country, was called, what was the nicknamed or referred to as the protecting power. And they were kind of the go-between between Germany and the Allies. And according to the Geneva Convention, which was signed by Germany along with the United States and Britain, there were certain rules or regulations about how to treat prisoners of war. And the Red Cross, I don't know what these prisoners would have done without the supplies that were sent to them by the Red Cross, although many times the Germans kept a lot of the Red Cross parcels for themselves. But that did help them stay alive. Most of the food that the prisoners of war got from the Germans themselves were bread filled with sawdust or some watery potato soup or something along those lines.
Operation Overlord, that's the code name for the Battle of Normandy. It's hard to envision a 12,000 plane airborne assault. That is an incredible 12,000 planes. And the amphibious landing, almost 7,000 vessels. That is absolutely amazing. Absolutely amazing that everything was coordinated in such a way and manner. And the air power after the Mustang was brought into the picture, who was escorting the B-17s, really changed things, didn't it?
It certainly did. Not only were the P-25 Mustangs better able to support the bombers, but they were also given the liberty to attack any ground target. So in addition to escorting the bombers, they would look for targets on the ground, whether it's a train or vehicle, convoy of vehicles, or an air base where they could destroy German fighters on the ground. So by the time D-Day came along, the German Air Force, the Luftwaffe, had been virtually wiped out. There wasn't a German plane really in the sky to bother the landing craft and all the troops storming the beaches.
You mention in your book how the Soviets did not have an agreement with the Geneva Convention, and consequently, the treatment that they got from the Germans, I don't think many people know about this, was horrific. Absolutely horrific.
Terrible, yes. The Soviets weren't a party to the Geneva Convention, so none of those rules applied. But the Germans looked really down upon the the Russian people or the Soviet people as kind of, I don't know if subhuman is the right word, but certainly below the Aryan race. And they treated Soviet prisoners absolutely horribly, and likewise the Russians treated the German prisoners horribly. After the Battle of Stalingrad, which was really the beginning of the end for Germany on the Eastern Front, the entire German Sixth Army surrendered, those who weren't killed, and there were hundreds of thousands of men that went to prison camp in Russia, with just a small, small percentage ever returning.
Mm-hmm. Yes, because the Russians said, "We're going to make you pay."
Exactly.
And they did. And they were just absolutely horrible. There is a section in your book called The Aftermath. In that section, the information that you give is, again, amazing. There was an assassination attempt on Hitler by Germans. They wanted to get rid of him, but he didn't get killed. There's a movie that was put out called Valkyrie with Tom Cruise, and it is a movie that depicts this. But there is so much regarding the death toll of this war. And the numbers, I don't know that we'll ever have accurately, but civilians that were killed went from 38 to 55 million. And 13 to 20 million of them were from war-related disease and famine. Military dead, 22 to 25 million, including deaths in captivity of about 5 million prisoners of war. The Soviet Union suffered the highest losses, followed by China, then Germany, Japan, France, United Kingdom, Italy, and United States. And in England, a total of 350,000 men served with the 8th Air Force, and of this number, 26,000 were killed, 18,000 were wounded, 28,000 crewmen ended up in POW camps, 4,000 evaded capture. More airmen with the 8th Air Force lost their lives than in the entire Marine Corps. These are numbers that, they're staggering.
It's just hard to comprehend. They're so large.
Yes. Yes.
And it's even harder for Americans because they weren't in countries that were devastated by the effects of war.
Yes. And 1,000 days of combat. 1,000 days. These stats were amazing to me. The 8th Air Force burned 1 billion gallons of gasoline, fired 99 million rounds of machine gun ammunition, dropped 732,000 tons of bombs, and destroyed 18,810 enemy aircraft. The B-17 and B-24 bombers had a short period of survival. The average bomber listed in service was only 147 days. 6,000 bombers were lost, with another 2,000 written off because they were damaged so badly. And more than 3,000 fighters were destroyed. I could just hear someone, a bean counter, with a calculator going tick, 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 tick. That's billions of dollars.
Yeah, the war was absolutely devastating. And there's no other event in human history that affected more people than World War II. There wasn't a country that was unaffected by it.
Incredible. And then the German civilians are about 800,000. The biggest amount of civilian killings were in Berlin, Hamburg, and Dresden, because that's where factories were. They had to do something. And the stories, they're still finding bombs today.
Yes, yes. I do a lot of speaking engagements. I developed a PowerPoint presentation that I make, or I sign books. And occasionally there'll be a person in the audience who was a young, or from German descent, who was a young child during the war, and they'll come up to me afterwards and tell me the horrific stories of what it was like to be near the bombings of Hamburg or Dresden or Berlin.
Mm-hmm. I know some people, too, that They're in their, some of them are in their 70s, their middle 70s, because they were very small. Others are in the early 90s that remember the war very vividly, very vividly. And most of them survived, and they said that they were very grateful for the Americans that came in. And I want to talk about the Belgian American Foundation. Dr. Paul Delahaye. This man, you need to tell his story and how this foundation, the Belgian American Foundation, came together.
I'd be glad to. Dr. Delahaye was a great man, a good friend of our family's. He passed away in 2013. But as a young boy, he was around 13, I think, when the war ended. But he and his family underwent the tragedies that took place in Belgium, and he saw firsthand the atrocities that the Nazis committed against not only his family, but friends and people who lived in the area. And he was greatly affected by it. And growing up later in life, he kind of became a local historian, and he formed an organization called the Belgium American Foundation, whose purpose was to remember and honor all the Allied troops that freed his country from Nazi occupation. And they've erected a number of memorials in the area in southern Belgium around the villages of Chimay and Momigny, one of them being to my dad's crew. It's the memorial of the Susan Ruth, where they'll have ceremonies this coming February 7th on a Sunday, to remember the plane being shot down on the 8th. And the memorial was erected in 1989, and he contacted my father, whose name he got from some of the Belgium helpers during the war. And he invited my dad to come over for the dedication, and he went over with my mother and three other members of the crew that were still living at the time for the dedication. And at that time, he was reunited with all his Belgium helpers, saw some of the houses and farms he was hidden at, and that's brought all the memories back. And that's when my dad really started talking mm-hmm. more about the war. But Paul was a great man. He and another gentleman, Jacques Lalot, who, like Paul, was a young boy during the war and greatly affected by it, they interviewed many, many Belgian citizens and members of the underground and recorded their testimony about the events that took place. And without their documentation and research, I'm not sure I ever would have written a book mm-hmm. because they gave me information and stories about things that would have been lost forever if they hadn't have done their research.
Yes, and Paul said, we can never forget. We have a duty to honor these soldiers. They died for the liberation of a country, not their own, and for people they didn't know. We must continue to thank them.
Yes, Paul has passed away, as I mentioned, but his eldest daughter, Crystal Delahaye, is now president of the foundation, which has since been renamed the Duty to Remember.
Mm-hmm.
And it is our duty to remember. We must never forget the sacrifice of those brave young men who fought and died for freedom. They're definitely the greatest generation.
It's an incredible book, Shot Down. Steve, I want to ask you a question. When you're listening to the newscasts of today, our world is very different from the world that your father was living in his young years. Today, we have young men and women who are doing just like your dad and his fellow pilots and fellow soldiers did. They believe very strongly in defending the rights of freedom. What would you want them to know?
Oh, gosh. Well, yeah, they don't get the honor and the recognition that they deserve. That's certainly true. But I think that they should realize and appreciate all the men and women that came before them who also served and fought and died for freedom. The freedoms that we enjoy in this country today were hard fought. They did not come easily. People needed to sacrifice, and people still need to sacrifice. And our military, both men and women, who protect us today, are doing the same things. So we need to honor them as well.
And support the reality that freedom is not just given. We do have to earn it, and we have to respect it, so that it is available for future generations.
Yes, a lot of people in the U.S. don't appreciate that. As I mentioned earlier, we've never been through a war. They've never seen, you know, the tragedy and destruction and death of war. And they don't realize that freedom comes at a price, and someone has to pay that price.
You have quite a phenomenal quote in here by President Eisenhower, and how he recalls, I won't say it exactly because it is something you really need to read, but he basically said that there was the day that when he walked across a battlefield, all he could see were the dead. That was it. That was all you could see. And he said it was at a particular battlefield, and he said it was the greatest killing field of any of the war areas. And he said it was a hell, an absolute hell. Steve Snyder, I want to thank you very much for being with me today. Your book, Shot Down, is a fabulous publication. I wish it could be presented in schools so young people would understand a bit of American history that they should be very much aware of and very proud of. Now, people can find out about you, your publication, by going to stevesnyderauthor.com. stevesnyderauthor.com. Thank you so very much for being my guest today.
Well, it's my pleasure and a delight to be on your program, Donna. Thank you very much.
You are very welcome, Steve. Again, Steve Snyder, Shot Down. Someone once said, if you don't learn from history, you are doomed to repeat it. But I want to say that there's a quote by James Worsham that I came across that I thought I'd close out the show with. Under normal periods, any person's success hinges about 5% on what others do for him and 95% on what he or she does, with the emphasis on does. The years that lie ahead will be no bed of roses for anyone. No matter how high the tide of prosperity may rise, no person will be able to share therein who does not gear himself or herself for their business to a new tempo to meet changing conditions and the problems and difficulties that await our solution. James Worsham was the gentleman that wrote those words. They were written a long time ago, but they still stand true. We have no guarantees in life. There is nothing that is going to keep us safe from tyrants, dictators, those that want to tell you what to do, how to do it, when to do it, take away all of your rights of choice. And this is so important for us to remember. We have to stand true to what we know is the right thing to do. And every one of us, no matter what our position in life might be, need to remember, as Steve Snyder has done with his publication, Shot Down, those that have gone before us from all environments. This was a war of wars against someone that hated the human being so much. It was incredible. I invite you to join me on Wednesdays. Also join me for the Donna Sebo Show, Monday through Friday from 9 to 10 a.m. Pacific Time, right here. Warriors for Peace, every Wednesday. Won't you join me again? This is Donna Sebo.
Thank you for joining me and my guests for this dynamic and informational hour. Tell your friends and family about the program. We look forward to having you join us again. Have a magnificent and free life.